People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. You're listening to Fine Music Radio, and this is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note. We have a special guest today who has just celebrated his 60th birthday, the composer Hans Husen, composer, baroque cellist and conductor with a special love for early European baroque music, rare traditions of indigenous South African music, as well as contemporary music of the kind that meaningfully responds to relevant contexts. Hans has been celebrating his 60th birthday for a year now, since February last year, and his birthday comes up in February this year. And there's been a special festival called 60 at the 60 at 60 Project. And so, Hans, first of all, welcome and congratulations on being 60.
Thank you very much.
And tell me more about the 60 at 60 Project, because it sounds like, A, a good idea, but B, also a bit of a challenge.
Yes, both is true.
Especially if you wanted to run it for a year.
The fact that 60 is this kind of threshold in a lifetime played a big role in coming up with this idea. Obviously, it's a time where you should have achieved most of the things that you had planned in your life. Time is running out, and you qualify as a pensioner.
Yeah.
So it is quite a challenge to get used to this, the fact that time just moves on. And so I thought I should make it a challenge as well and try to initiate 60 performances of own works during the course of this year in the vein sort of do a retrospective of what I have written in a career of about 40 years of composing music.
I was going to say it must have been difficult to cut it down, let alone to find out what to play.
Well, I decided not to write anything new in this year and rather take stock of what I have and also try to promote it, because obviously things just don't get played on their own unless you suggest it, unless you find suitable situations and occasions and interested musicians, of course. So I made a point of putting out some music, so scores online and recordings online, and making them accessible for free to anybody who wanted to participate, ranging from timbre music to orchestral music to solo music, choral music. Put up the 60 at 60 website, inviting basically anybody and everybody who was keen to schedule anything in an existing.
So it was very open.
It was completely open. These days, I find that to try and guard your music behind a paywall doesn't really make sense, because it doesn't get performed a lot either way, and to rather open it and make it public domain in a sense. Even so, it was quite difficult to find interested parties, because obviously everybody is very busy. I'm not a young, interesting composer anymore. I've been around, so people are looking for the youngsters.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the topics are quite specific, being South African, having this interest in early music, which was a phase 40 years ago, which is not so important maybe anymore. Indigenous African music is quite a specialized interest. So I would say my music isn't run-of-the-mill mainstream. But even so, I'm proud to report that to date, there have been 51 performances.
Oh, gosh. So you're only 9 short.
I'm 9 short. It also depends on how you count, because I could also, there has been a performance of 9 arrangements in one concert in Bonn. And if I would count all 9, then I would actually have made the 60. But since there are 2 or 3 weeks more to go, I might just hope that the one or the other might still crop up.
It's interesting, early Baroque and African music seem poles apart. Maybe they're not.
To my mind, they're not. And it's actually quite a simple approach, I think. If you take indigenous African music as a form of early music that is specific to a location, then that is very much the same approach if you look at, say, Italian Baroque music or French Renaissance music or something of the kind. So it means you have to take into consideration a certain period of time and a certain locality and the culture that prevails at that place and time.
Is the African music then from a similar period as the Baroque, or would it go back further possibly?
Well, arguably it's much more ancient. That's very difficult to pinpoint, because obviously traditions are floating. There was very little, hardly any written records of musical practice in Africa. And whether what we have access to in field recordings from the 60s or 30s, 20s of the previous century is the same as it would have been several centuries ago is impossible to state. Mm. So that is basically impossible to answer. But I think the important thing about my approach is that you take African music out of that exotic realm where it is completely foreign and where you have no access to it. And if you take it as a specific form of expression, of which there were or still are a few informed musicians, then it is something that can be studied, that can be understood if you understand the context, and becomes something that you can also then perform in an informed manner, just as we do with Baroque music.
So would you, this might be a stupid question, but you think of Baroque music and using period instruments. What instruments would you use for the African music, well, the same original instruments?
You would try to get the historical period instruments, the authentic instruments. In this case, we often call them indigenous or traditional African instruments, which is pretty much, it's nothing special. It's what people would have used at the time. Mm-hmm. And obviously, African musicians now use any modern instruments as well as Europeans do. So it's a natural thing that a musician always uses what is available at his time. And I think the important distinction that the early music revival made is to take out that change is equal to improvement. So to argue that a modern piano is better than a historic piano is, that is sort of the fallacy of progress. If you consider it to have specific qualities, even though in hindsight they might look limited compared to a modern piano, but those qualities are what artists were working with, and therefore to say that it is not as good as a modern piano doesn't make sense. I mean, would Bach have written his, or would he preferred his music to be played on a fagioli is a futile question, because the concept of a fagioli wasn't around, yet Bach composed his music to be performed.
Yes, I hear you. You're absolutely right. Of course, it is. Just the other day, I was at a fagioli recital. And although it was Chopin, so it was not Baroque music, but it really is an impressive thing. And you can't help thinking what Beethoven would have thought of the piano like that, or even earlier, Mozart. But yet, as you say, they wrote their masterpieces for the instruments of that day, and they sounded like masterpieces.
Yes. I mean, it would be impossible to think that they would have written the music and say, well, I'll have to wait for a few centuries before this can be realized.
That would never have happened, would it? Let's take a music break, Hans, and your first piece of music actually demonstrates something African, doesn't it? Audite Africam. Tell us what we're about to hear.
Well, I might just mention to make the link to the 6860 project. So, Audita was one of the pieces that was performed as part of the project. It was a collaboration with UCT, with the UCT String Orchestra. I conducted the concert in the Baxter Hall and suggested that we do Audita, which was written in 1997, so a fairly long time ago when I was still in Munich. It was a commission by Audi, the car maker in Ingolstadt, hence the title, Audita.
Yes.
The engineer that founded Audi had a German surname, which was Horch, and then he Latinized his name. So Horch means to hearken, to listen carefully. And Audita, of course, means all the audio roots.
The audio side.
Exactly, come from Audita. Yes. So I thought, there's a link between the brand and the music. I don't think anybody picked it up, but nevertheless. And the title means, Audita Africa means hearken or listen to Africa. And the commission was written for the Georgian Chamber Orchestra, which was a string orchestra which had fled from Georgia to Germany and had been sponsored by Audi. So they got a new home in Ingolstadt. And the work consists of five movements, which each in a way refers to a certain technique or a certain style of indigenous African music, which I was studying at that time. And so we're going to listen to the first movement, which makes use of a typical timeline pattern and some cross rhythms. Thank you.
Piece was called Audite Africam, the first movement of a suite for string orchestra, written by Hans Hussen, who is my guest here in the studio of People of Note, brought to you by Peter Turin Productions. And also, we're celebrating his 60th birthday, which he, Hans, has been celebrating for a year with a 60 at 60 project, of which that was part. And so I want to just talk a little bit more about the 60 at 60 project, because you mentioned, I think you said mentioned Bonn. Did it take place in Germany as well, or have you only done it in South Africa?
No, no. The idea was that anybody, anywhere in the world, within this year...
That when you did your open thing...
Exactly, yeah.
So anyone, anywhere in the world...
Anybody could participate. That's why I thought it shouldn't be too difficult to get 60 performances done. So there was no restriction.
Did you get responses from all over the place?
Well, as I said, the responses weren't overtly enthusiastic. I had to query and push a little bit, but in the end, as I say, we got those 51 performances. One of my colleagues who took it on quite seriously was Anne-Marie van der Westhuizen, the cellist, who performed one of my pieces in New York, in Vienna, and in Salzburg. She was traveling and did recital of South African compositions, and one of my pieces was part of that.
Oh, good for you.
The person in Bonn was a colleague of many years, Bettina van Dombois, a violinist who spent her formative child years in Cape Town, has a very soft spot for the country, visits often, and has a class of violin students in Bonn. And she performed a whole set of arrangements that I've done for the Musikits project. So 11 performances in Bonn.
Which make up the 60, as you said earlier,
exactly.
Or almost, or even more. Yeah.
Then the Cape Consort, my own group, of course, was forced to participate. They had no choice. We played concert with only my works in the Welchemin concert series, and we had a show at the Wurtfiers. Another group that was that I was very happy that was participating was the Cape Town Chamber Choir, a beautiful lay choir, but very proficient. And there were performances in Zurich with a student choir, mostly in Cape Town. The Zangwatini Choir was also involved. Let me look at my list. We had concerts in Munich and the area with Così Facciamo, which is a German ensemble. And then Vox, John Woodland's choir, also brought their part to the 60. They had commissioned a cycle of four Afrikaans settings a few years ago, and they performed that on several occasions.
So it really was quite widespread, Hans. What was the most exotic place you got an inquiry from, just purely as a matter of fun interest?
I suppose New York is...
Really?
From this perspective, I don't have very many performances there usually.
No, I mean, I wonder if you'd got anything from, say, a remote eastern country like Kazakhstan or...
No, I'm afraid I didn't.
To Tegucigalpa on the Galapagos. But it's the mainstream, so you've had good mainstream coverage, actually, in those cities you mentioned.
Well, I wouldn't say mainstream.
The cities were mainstream.
The cities are nice to, yeah.
To have your music.
The name dropping of Vienna and New York. But I mean, it's out of the millions of performances of music that happened there, a single one does really make a difference. But that's
don't put yourself down now. I think to be performed in New York must be quite a feeling, and in places like Munich.
It's a strange thing that when you have performances that are very far away, you're actually in no way involved.
Yes.
And you might sleep through it, or you might have dinner while somebody else is performing. It's a strange feeling of remoteness.
Also letting your music go, like letting your children leave home.
Yes.
And go away and study.
And of course you wish for them to fly and have a life of their own.
So the 60-60 now, okay, your birthday is now coming up this month in February. Is this now the end? What are you going to do after that?
Well, I was toiling with doing 61 at 61, but I'm not going to do that.
Maybe not. The novelty will have worn.
No, I think it's time to get back to my desk and write again. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of sorting also to be done. So you end up having scores and different versions, and you have recordings, and you note that, I just noted the other day that Fine Music Radio actually has only one CD. So I'll have to stock you up. There's far more content.
Please do.
There's also this ongoing marketing thing. You have to make yourself known and advertise. Mm-hmm. And that I find quite challenging because I don't see myself as wanting to shout out all the time. But times have changed. One has to get attention.
Of social media and all that sort of stuff that you have to be on.
We can speak
otherwise,
about
people
that
forget about you, don't they? It's a bit depressing.
You don't even know you're around.
Exactly. Yeah. Hans, our next piece of music I see has a German influence. Tell me about what we're going to hear, Geistliche Chormusik.
Yes, Geistliche Chormusik is a title that I've borrowed from Heinrich Schütz. He titled one of his collections for a cappella motets. In that way. And this is a project that dates back to the COVID time when we were forced to stay at home. And I had time to look through some of my old occasional pieces that I had written for baptisms and confirmations and that I considered occasional in the sense that they were performed on one occasion and that would have been that. And I found that some of those pieces might merit a little... restoration.
Tweaking,
improving.
All that.
And so I thought, well, what if I act as the composition teacher that I didn't have when I was a teenager back in Pretoria? I looked at these things and came up with 12 pieces that I thought would stand the test of time.
All that you'd written like that as a little occasional
pieces. Well, in the course of 40 years, but actually the eldest date back to the 1980s,
okay.
When I was still in high school. Yeah. And then I submitted them to a German publisher, and lo and behold, they got published by Strube, which is a publishing house in Munich, which focuses on choral music. And yes, I'm actually very happy about this, the development of this, because a lot of these pieces were performed during the 60 at 60 project. And we're going to listen to one of them performed by the Cape Consort, directed by Antoinette Hussen.
That's Mrs. Hussen, that's your wife, Antoinette.
Correct. And we're going to listen to one of these motets, which is titled Dein Wort sei meines Fußes Leuchte, written in 2018. Dein Wort.
one of the Geistliche Chormusik, written by my guest Hans Hüssen, and performed, what was the group you said?
It was the Cape Consort.
Oh, the Cape Consort, there you are. A whole set of songs there. And we're talking to Hans about his 60 at 60 project, which has been running now for almost a year. And would you say, Hans, as you approach your 61st birthday, has it been a success? Are you a happy chappy?
I'm a happy chappy because I'm still alive and kicking. I'm not joking. If you think of how many composers died at a very young age.
Yes,
so I'm beyond Mozart, Mendelssohn, Schubert, who had to finish their output much earlier than I still have the time to do. But, it's difficult to judge it a success. I would have preferred if there would have been more resonance. Maybe we can speak about that word. I find it quite important.
Resonance?
Resonance in the sense that you don't have to push your own work, that, as I say, there's an interest that develops.
Okay.
That it makes sense for other people. I think it's not so much, you know, being in the foreground as a composer, but that the kind of music speaks to a wider context, which is not only important for yourself, but also for the musicians that would perform it.
And the audience?
And, of course, the audience, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think before it gets to an audience, there's always this whole complex of how is this going to fit into an existing program, into an existing ensemble, into a season of concerts? How is it funded? How will the audience react to it? So it becomes quite a complex.
And that's referred to as resonance.
Well, no, with resonance, I mean arguably what a composer is looking for, communicating and receiving some kind of feedback.
Okay.
And as a performing musician, I found the concept of resonance, it's what happens in an acoustic space, in the venue. So you can't play in a very dry space because it just doesn't resonate, it doesn't come back. But you can also not play in a place that is too resonant, so if it overwhelms you. And there are the famous examples, for example, the Musikverein in Beethoven, which is hailed as one of the most the best-sounding concert halls, this shoebox design.
Yes, in Vienna.
Wooden floor.
Vienna, yes.
And it just sounds brilliant. So it's this measure of what you put out and what you get back.
I understand.
Where it's also referring to the kind of attention that you have. So you don't have to shout and you don't have to use a microphone and, you know, elbow your way out into the awareness of other people. But it presumes a kind of interest and attention and awareness in which what you say then falls on fertile ground and has
very
a meaning.
So
this concept is very important to me. And obviously, if you find that there is hardly any response to performances, either because it's too seldom, there's no continuity, or people can't relate to it because it's too exotic, this is South African and it's early music and it's all about fynbos or whatever, then that is often quite disheartening. That
I'm sure it must be. But, I mean, Hans, that's a tricky subject, isn't it, for modern composers, South African or otherwise.
Oh, it's an
you
awful
people
subject.
Really have to battle to get your music heard. And we're always told that when Beethoven's music was heard, it was new, the Eroica Symphony. No one had ever heard anything like that before. But the audience is now a little more, I should say, a little less adventurous.
Well, this is a big topic. I would say at the moment the pressing issue is this so-called attention industry, social media and advertising, which loudly grabs everybody's attention. And there is very little space for anybody who perceiving just what is around without being forced into something and forced to block it out and to shut things down. So to work in an environment where you actually have to be careful not to spam an audience is becomes very tricky.
Gosh, that's an interesting concept, spam an audience, because the social media would do that, wouldn't it?
Well, it's we're confronted with that every day, and I sometimes feel to send out a marketing email to your database, you have to do that very carefully, because being aware that people get so much information and you don't want to do that, you know, become part of that problem. Yet you have to do it, otherwise you don't have an audience. So it's a
it's a vicious circle, in a sense. Yeah. Now, one of the things I wanted to talk about as we move along is your interest in a category of paraphrases, extensive arrangements of early music. What do you mean by that? And I know we're going to listen to an example in a moment, but just explain what you mean by that.
Well, part of the process of looking back on what I have done, it's quite interesting to see that sometimes you sort of end up doing the same thing or ending up in the same rut. And I've found that there are a couple of categories which crop up in my output. And the one is that I like to paraphrase, in other words, rework existing music. I think that is probably how I started to compose, working with, say, traditional folk songs and arranging them, but in the process doing a little bit more than just an arrangement, changing it, translating it for a certain context.
Like rhythmically, harmonically, the actual meat and bones of the piece.
Yes, you can insert things, you can leave out things, you can harmonize it in an unexpected way, you can spice it up with some kind of rhythm, so there are infinite possibilities. And one of the works in which I've done this on a large scale is the Lassus Fantasy, which was my first piece for orchestra.
Lassus, the...
Orlando Baroque, di Lasso, the...
Renaissance Baroque.
Yes, the composer in Munich. Yeah. And after my studies in Salzburg, I moved to Munich in the, I think it was 1992, and Munich was celebrating 500 years of Lassus. And so that came up. And as a cellist, I played some of the very simple two-part fantasies by Lassus. And so I expanded one of these two-part pieces into a piece for full orchestra. So somewhere amongst the rich and varied orchestration, there is a thread of Lassus going through. But of course, it becomes a piece in its own right. And we might listen to the opening of the Lassus Fantasy, played by the Mozarteum Orchestra in Salzburg, conducted by Georges Rotter. The whole piece is about 11 minutes long, so we might fade out after a few minutes.
Thank you. Well, now that was part of the Lassus Fantasy for Huge Orchestra, and it was reimagined, as the word they use these days, Hans, by my guest today, Hans Hoessen, who is celebrating his 60th birthday and has been for a few months now until he turns 61 now in February with a project called the 60 at 60 Project. I want to go back, Hans, to ask you more about your background. You said you started, when you started composing, arranging songs. Was music always going to be part of your life when you were a little boy?
I suppose it was. My mother was very fond of singing. She still is. She's turned 90 recently. I owe her the exposure to this truly rich treasure of German folk songs. So she would sing with us as kids, but she would also maintain a circle of friends in Pretoria, all South Africans but of German descent, that would meet, I think, four times a year over a weekend to sing.
Wow, what a lovely idea.
And one of her friends was an amateur conductor, and so they would sing four-part settings of spiritual music, folk music. So that was a real lived tradition, not to be frowned upon. Because that is, to look back now, it might seem a bit old-fashioned, but I would say my parents really cherished this, and this whole circle of friends, it was important for them. So I had this direct exposure, and I might add that if I had grown up in Germany, this would have been impossible, because at that time, folk song or singing in Germany was, you would say, taboo because of the Third Reich. And the Nazi appropriation of folk culture.
Of course.
So being in South Africa, there was a sufficient distance that people could approach the music without having the political awareness that this was actually not kosher.
Amazing.
One of the advantages of growing up in the diaspora, and there is a saying that the Germans in South Africa are, in a way, more German or more traditionally German than those in the Bundesbürger in.
Gosh, that's very interesting, actually. I would never have thought that. And then did you then go on to take up an instrument? The cello is your instrument, isn't
it?
Well,
the other anecdote that I have to tell you is that I went to the German school in Pretoria, and in Standard 3, we had a German – our class teacher was teaching German and music, and he was a German that had come to South Pretoria for his contract time of 6 years. And if it hadn't been for him, I don't think – I would have taken up music.
My goodness.
Because he was, in a very natural way, enthusiastic. And he, one day, well, he started an ensemble with Orff instruments and recorders and guitars. And then one day he just needed a cello. And my godmother happened to have an instrument in her cupboard. And she gave it to me and said, well, you can try it out. And at first I wasn't allowed because my hands were too small. And eventually I just ended up doing that. And being diligent.
Yes, of course.
I kept practicing, and then when I was in matric, my crush at that time was a flautist who was going to study music, and I thought, well, I might just as well do a year of music before I join the engineering pathway of my father, and then another year and another year, and here we are.
The rest, as they say, is history, that famous expression. So it's thanks to a flautist that you're a cellist and a composer.
A flautist, a godmother, whatever things that play a role.
And then it was then that your compositional side also came to the fore, was it?
That came...
As opposed to just messing around, if you don't mind me using that expression.
Yes, I had no formal instruction back then. I did enroll for composition when I got to Stellenbosch for my BMAS. I studied with Rudolf Temming, but I also majored in cello. So I also had these two poles. Then I went to Salzburg to pursue my cello studies. Salzburg, being the very traditional town it is, didn't provide a lot of stimulus for composition. But I met a young composer with whom I did my master's in Munich. So moving from Salzburg to Munich was basically following my wish to compose. And then while I lived in Munich and started off as a freelance composer, I was put into the African box. And that ultimately led to my return to South Africa.
How do you mean you were put in the African box?
As being a composer and not doing the new music, Donau Eschingen, Darmstadt avant-garde thing, people looked at me and said, well, you're an African, so where's the African music? And I thought, that's a good question. Where is my African music? And so while I was in Munich, I started listening to recordings and transcribing field recordings and realizing this inexplicable link to Indigenous music, which I could have listened to while I was here, but I didn't, because when I was a youngster, everything was focused on well, you're a German and you need to, you know, go to Europe, and that's where music happens. Again, from the diaspora, from the distance, I suddenly realized how interesting, how intricate, how important, how marginalized African music is. And the idea to write opera, the Mask, my African opera, fermented in Munich. I met Ilya Trojanov, my librettist there, and then came back what I thought would be a year to write the piece. And again, the rest is history.
Africa
is not to be understood in a year. And I must say, in spite of all the negative aspects, if you look at it from a cultural point of view, I love being in Africa. This is where I feel at home. And there's a lot to be done culturally. So it's one thing to live in a cultural center where you can bathe in what is going on and be part of a rich and sophisticated cultural life, and it's another to be creative, and it doesn't really matter.
Talking about your fascination, really, with African music, which has taken its place right through your life, let's listen to a piece here which you call Songs of Madosini. Just explain what we're going to hear.
Maybe if I may, to disconnect with this, the opera. So Mask was performed exactly 20 years ago in 2005. It was one of Angelo Gobato's last productions. And it fell in that period of Mandela euphoria. Everybody's dreaming of the Rainbow Nation and a reconciliatory politics. And it was a moment where I thought that you could bring all the different cultures, the diversity, onto a stage on a par without patronizing each other and creating a dialogue and starting to understand where all of us stand. I think it was a very unique window of opportunity, which has long since been closed. I don't think a work like Mask would still be possible. It has also never been performed again, so this was a single run 20 years ago. But on a smaller scale, it was, of course, possible to continue with this, my African fascination. And one of my, I would say, really successful pieces were the Songs of Madosini, which also entailed a continuous collaboration with La Torsi and Pashlini, this Pondomise queen of music, which we all know as Madosini. She has unfortunately passed away 2 years ago, which also means that piece can never be performed again, because it always factually involved her. She had to be present. And we performed that, I think, 17 times. We traveled and toured to Austria and to Germany and all over South Africa. And even though Madosini could only speak deep Xhosa, and I couldn't, of course, we were able to befriend each other and communicate on a musical level, which was really rewarding and enriching. So the piece started off, was a commission by Miyagi. Again, I did some transcriptions of recordings of Madosini, and then created kind of a suite with a narrator, which showcases six of the songs that she performs and frames them with a string quartet and a clarinet and this narrator, and in a way tries to take this very, how shall I say, cyclic African form of self-entertaining music making onto a concert stage, where you would expect some kind of dramatic development in a piece, and demonstrate the dialogue, convey something of the African history, expose the audience to the unique sounds of the period instruments, in this case being Uhadi, Umhube, Isitolotolo, and showcase a period performer, in this case Madosini, as a really informed indigenous knowledge bearer, extremely skilled in playing those instruments on the same technical level as Western trained musician. So we had 17 performances of this work. There is also a studio recording, of which we now hear the first movement with an English translation of the text.
Now I want to tell you about Umhobe. Was a favorite instrument amongst us Xhosa girls. We learned to play it when we were little. You would never find us without our instruments, even when we were playing in the veld. Back then we did not have TV or radio. We didn't have any of those things. But God gave us Umhube so that we had something to entertain ourselves. Umjeko was one of the songs that we'd sing while running errands or playing. There would be a girl to lead the procession. Following her, we would praise her, egging her on to keep her happy. That was before my knee injury. I could still run then, and I was the leader of the procession. One day, a certain girl went around the village spreading a rumor about me. She was telling people that she had seen me eating chicken and eggs. I was disgraced, because back then it was against the law for Khoza girls to eat chicken, eggs, or any form of fowl. I could not leave it at that. I would have my revenge, and we would fight it out. Either she would defeat me, or I would put the shame back on her. Finally, the day of settling the score arrived. It was a Friday. We gathered at Tuunta. Then we walked down the road towards the shop at Mpeko, where the fight was to take place. There we were, my friend and I, resolutely marching out of the village at the sound of Umjeko, a determined little procession, ready to finish off those other girls. Let us go! Those were good times. The fights were only games, of course, and we had a lot of fun. The life of an Umhube player was wonderful. We did not have TV or radio, and we had no need for them, because we had our instruments. You can stop now.
That was the second movement of the Songs of Madosini. Now, Hans Huysen is my guest here on People of Note this week, talking, as we have, about African music. But apart from Africa, local has also inspired you. And I know, although you were born in Pretoria, I think you've spent a fairly long time living in the Cape, either in Stellenbosch or in Cape Town. And in fact, teaching at UCT. Didn't you do that for a while?
For a while, before roads had to fall.
Let's not go there. But the next piece, I'm interested because it's called Cape Floral Kingdom. How did that come about? I mean, this is not actually African music, or is it?
Well, this touches on what I said earlier, the categories of works. And one category is sort of an environmentally aware way of composing, trying to culturally express this incredible miracle of the Cape Coral Kingdom that we have, being one of the plant kingdoms of the whole world, the smallest and the most diverse. So whenever I have free time, I try to be out and hike or take photographs of flowers. And one expression was this orchestral work, the Proteus Variations, which CPO has performed. And another work on a much smaller scale is a set of five duets for voice and cello called the Floral Miniatures, based on texts which my wife wrote many years back, haikus depicting or reflecting on a certain plant of this kingdom. And this was also a COVID project when both of us finally had time to do things that take careful planning and a certain mindset which you can't rush. And so I would like to suggest that we listen to the fifth of these floral miniatures, which depicts the King Protea.
An excerpt from the Cape Floral Kingdom. And there we heard my guest, Hans Huysen, as the cellist. Who was the lady singing with you?
My wife, Antoinette.
Ah, I know your wife is very involved with choirs and things as well, isn't she?
She is the chorus master of Cape Town Opera since a few months. And she also directs the children's choir of the opera and the Cape Town Chamber Choir.
Oh, my. I think we can safely call you a musical family.
I suppose.
I wanted to ask you, in your biog, there was something there that I thought, now what is he on about here? It says, and I quote, "Complexity thinking has enabled Hans to integrate diverse musical interests and to combine artistic and academic work in many different ways." Is it possible to clarify that? Because the complex phenomenon has been used before in your biog. What do you mean by complexity thinking?
Well, this is a big topic. I'll try to be very brief. I was exposed to complexity thinking as a philosophical context when I was a STIAS fellow about 10 years ago by a wonderful scholar with the name of Paul Cellier. Paul has unfortunately also passed away. But that was a complete eye-opener and really changed my mind. I did a PhD because it provided such a useful approach to think about music in a novel way and in a diverse way. So to try to briefly explain it, if you think of any phenomenon or any object, this can in our language, it is usually treated as isolated. If I look at this glass, we speak about a glass, but this glass is at a certain temperature in a certain place, so it stands in a certain context, and it can be filled, it can be used to drink, but it's also fragile, it can break. It might be historic, it might be expensive. So there are all sorts of different angles to a single object, and this is touching on the complexity of a simple thing. Now, if we speak about culture or music or society, then that is, of course, far more complex, because there are so many takes on it. And what is meaningful to one person is maybe not at all meaningful to somebody else. It might have a different kind of meaning, different importance. So music is an example of a complex phenomenon par excellence. And it frees me from having to think only of, say, the technicalities involved, or the status, or the historicity, or the cultural valuation, or the exam marks, or the this, that, and the other. And I can always say, well, music can be that, but it certainly is more than that. And it's actually always more than meets the eye or the ear or you think. And the same applies if you think about indigenous African music and, say, avant-garde European music. These are two phenomena that are so far apart that it's very difficult to relate them. But if you consider them as being expressions of human beings, and human beings are complex beings that have a body, that live a natural life, but also participate in a culture, in a spiritual life, then their form of expression meets on a certain level. And the diversity is explained by the complexity of the relations. So I found this a very helpful concept to bind together my various interests of European music, of early music, of contemporary music, of indigenous music, of music that refers to extra musical topics like nature or culture. And it's helped me to understand myself, because very often I've had this question: so who are you actually? Are you a cellist? Are you a composer? Are you a South African? Are you a German? What is your interest? Is it early music? Is it contemporary music? Are you a conductor? Are you an academic? Are you a teacher? And obviously don't want to be a jack of all trades, but I also find it very hard to say I'm only this or only that. And so I would like to say that I'm a complex human being, but also fascinated with the complexity of music as something that, even after working for 40 years and being 60 now, I haven't really started to understand.
But what came through there with your explanation, and I know it's difficult to explain that, the complexity thinking has actually freed you. It's made it easier for you, as opposed to more complex.
Yes. As I say, it's basically a opening up of the concept.
Yeah.
And so anything that comes to mind can be understood as related. And I think it also frees up the individual take. As a teacher at the school, I have come to appreciate that every human being is musical. It's just that this musicality is individual, and you can't measure it according to the same benchmark. That's why I'm really struggling to believe exam marks, because there's this sort of objective standard, and there is no such thing if you look at the diversity of personalities. And I think that every person is entitled to live his own musical life. And just because he can't sing or can't play an instrument, you can't say he's not musical. He might, he will, or she will have a personal take on music.
It's good to hear
is okay.
But we have to leave it there, Hans. Hans Hosen has been my guest. And as we leave, let's wish you a happy 61st birthday for later this week.
Thank you very much.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
FMR 101.3.